No tuckamy. Alert, 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 extreme groan alert. Just warning you. I've given you warning. The story goes that there was a man named Tim who was a fan of tractors all of his life. When he was a young boy, he had a tractor bedspread. He had toys and he had posters. He would tell all his friends at school of the latest tractor models being made, and he loved tractors more than just about anything else. The years went by, and eventually Tim was old enough to actually drive a tractor, and so for his birthday present, his parents took him to a local tractor factory to test the latest model of tractor. Tim was told in the tour all about the amazing technology that went into this brand new machine. And then, as he was almost bursting with excitement, he got to drive a tractor for the very first time of his life. However, the amazing technology was not quite what Tim had imagined, and a horrific mechanical fault nearly left Tim dead or horribly injured. Tim, in that moment, became very disillusioned, and he began to hate tractors. He had loved them so much of his life, but they turned out to not be the wonderful machines that he had dreamed of. Years later, again, Tim was at a sauna, at a spa, and he thought he spied a beautiful-looking woman through the fog, the steam of the sauna. And he wanted desperately to talk to this lovely woman, but he couldn't see her through the steam. So Tim suddenly stood up. He sucked in all the steam in the room, went outside, and blew it all outside. He went back into the now clear room and sat down next to the lady. "Wow, that was incredible," she said. "How did you do that?" "Easy," said Tim, "I warned you. I'm an ex-tractor fan." Come on. I told you it was a groaner. I'm never really sure if people care about sermon titles. I put them in every week, but I just don't know. But I really hope you paid attention to today's. The story behind it still makes me chuckle to this day. Years ago, when Laura and I lived in a condominium building in Scarborough, I met a lovely older lady named Pauline. And one evening, she was relating a very cute story to those who were present about her 3-year-old grandson. And Pauline had been babysitting him, and it was about time to get the grandson to either go to bed or do something that he clearly did not want to do. And with all the bravado and bluster a 3-year-old could muster, he turned to his grandmother, put up the palm of his hand out towards her, and shouted, "No tuckamy!" It's a phrase that has stuck with me, and I must admit, I've been known to use it here in the church in jest. I've used it, I know, with Pam a few times. I must admit that many times in most days that I watch the news, or I look at Facebook, or I read a newspaper, and I just want to shout out, "No talk of me." In other words, I really don't want to hear it. I've recently begun to wonder if one of the primary things that unites us as a society today might not be disillusionment. It seems to be me that disillusionment is everywhere. It's on all sides of us. Now, we may not agree on what it is that causes disillusionment in us, but I think it's a common disease from which everyone is suffering. There's disillusionment with our leaders. There's disillusionment with our political system, with economic opportunities, with the endless wars and violence that we see, with prejudice and oppression, with religion and the church too. I suspect disillusionment is in large part what helps some politicians today to get elected, and I think that's especially true with President Trump right now. And President Trump continues in this current campaign to fuel disillusionment to keep his followers loyal to him. I suspect disillusionment is also what energizes those who are on the other side of the political divide, who disagree with President Trump. Behind the vitriol of recent political ads, and there's lots of them now on American television, there's disillusionment. Lots of it. Disillusionment is what drives the Me Too movement. It's why people festoon their cars in this town with vulgar bumper stickers about our prime minister. It's why we are heartbroken and angry over the sex abuse scandals in the Catholic Church, or recently the famous fashion mogul Nygaard. I read disillusionment in Facebook posts. I hear it in conversations. I hear it in accusations. I recognize it in the decline of church attendance and influence. And every one of us in this room could tell a story about our own personal disillusion. The disillusion that is unique and particular to our life and our life circumstance. Haven't you had times of disillusionment? Times when you recognize that your life or the world around you wasn't what we thought it should be or could be? It may never be. Disillusionment happens when the story we told ourselves, the story on which we have based our lives and beliefs, the story to which we have committed ourselves no longer makes sense, is no longer relevant, no longer works, no longer true. Disillusionment is an in-between time, a time when we've lost faith in the old familiar story, but have not yet embraced another story. It leaves us panicked and fearful about the future. The world feels like a dangerous and chaotic place. It seems out of control for us, and somebody needs to do something about it. Does any of that sound familiar to you? Do you understand what I'm talking about here? Do you want to muster up the courage, stand outside your house or your apartment or whatever, and shout to the world, "No talk of me"? What's your disillusionment today? What exactly is eating away at you and stealing your joy? Disillusionment, however, and this is critically important, isn't only about what's going on around us. It actually begins within us. Ultimately, disillusionment is a spiritual issue. And it's the one the Apostle Peter knows very well. In today's gospel lesson, he is the picture of disillusionment. He has confessed that Jesus is the Messiah. He has a particular story, though, about who the Messiah is and what the Messiah should do and be about. Who doesn't? Jesus, however, is about to undo and rewrite Peter's whole story about the Messiah. The Son of Man, he says, must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. So much for Peter's story about what the Messiah is about. That's neither what he expected, and it's certainly not what he wanted. So he takes Jesus aside and he rebukes him, as if he knows more and better than Jesus. In Matthew's version of the story, we hear what Peter says to Jesus. "God forbid, Lord. This shall never happen to you." Can you see and hear Peter's disillusionment? Peter confesses, and then Peter rebukes, all with the same tongue in the same conversation. He's speaking with a forked tongue. Or as a friend of mine used to say, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. It's what James is describing in the epistle lesson read for us today. Listen to the disillusionment in your own life and in the life of another, and you'll likely hear blessing and cursing come from the same mouth. With the tongue, James says, we bless the Lord, the Father, and we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. The forked tongue is a symptom of the division within us. The division we see out there is a projection of the division within us. It reveals our panic disillusionment. It reveals our arrogance. Often panic disillusionment comes with the arrogance that we know exactly where things are headed or should be headed, and we think we know what should be done. Peter's confession and his rebuke have become his disillusionment and his arrogance. My brothers and sisters, James continues, this ought not to be so. We know that, right? James states the obvious. This ought not to be so. Our disillusionment is not an excuse to curse or rebuke one another. It is not a basis for claiming we know more and better than anyone else. It is not a reason to declare or treat others as less than us when that other has been created and loved by the same God who created and loved us. The arrogance of panic disillusionment can quickly lead to self-assertion. We can see that in Peter and his rebuke of Jesus. I'm not saying all of this as a criticism or judgment of Peter, but in recognition of and identification with the times in my own life and my own disillusionment when I've been arrogant and I've used self-assertion. Jesus has no time for or interest in Peter's arrogant self-assertion. Get behind me, Satan, he said. Those are the same words Jesus spoke during his temptation in the wilderness. Jesus hears Peter's rebuke as a temptation to be less than who he is, to be a distraction from the work he is called to do. And maybe that's true for Peter, and it's true for you and me too. Disillusion tempts us to be less than who we truly are, tempts us to be arrogant and self-assertive, tempts us to lose sight of what we're really about. I came across an unusual, and it's a fictitious story, so don't hear any more than that. It was created by a man by the name of John Lawrence. He wrote a book called Down to Earth. And in this fictitious story, it goes that the devil had advertised that he was going to put on sale all of his tools of the trade. On the day of kind of like a yard sale, he has all his tools placed out for public inspection, with each piece having a sale price attached to it. It was a treacherous lot of implements. The usual tools we would expect were there. There was hatred, there was jealousy, there was doubt, there was lying, pride, so on and so forth. And laid apart from the rest of the pile was a harmless looking tool. It was well worn and it had a really high price on it. "What's the name of that tool?" asked one of the customers. "Oh," said the adversary, "that's discouragement. Why is it priced so high? Because it is more useful than all the others. I can pry open and get inside a person's heart with that one when I cannot get near him with other tools. Now, once I get inside, I can make him do what I choose. It's a badly worn tool because I use it on almost everyone since few people know it belongs to me. You see, disillusionment can be our undoing. It can be our undoing as individuals and as a community. In our disillusionment, we often put our story in front of God's story. We give more credence to what we see rather than what God sees. And we take our story to be more real than God's story. Isn't that what Peter's done here? Isn't that what's going on in all the conflicts we have with everyone else? In the times we assert ourselves or we negate the other person, in our words and our actions of violence even, in our panic arrogance, we can easily and quickly betray ourselves, we can betray each other, and we can betray God. Despite what the prophets of doom say and what we feel, the world is not coming to an end. It's not falling apart. It's not going to hell in a handbasket. It wasn't for Peter, and it isn't for you and I. The truth is, we don't understand what's happening, and we feel lost, we feel scared, we get angry, and we get confused. The old story of power and self-assertion no longer fits. But it never did. But we heard that story, and we're told it to ourselves enough times that we begin to believe and we invest in that old story. We, you and I, we need to embrace a different story. Jesus gives Peter, he gives all of us a new story because he's the story. His is a story of self-denial. If you want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. It's not just a story that Jesus tells, it's a story that Jesus lives. And if any want to become his followers, that story has to become your story too. Look what self-denial looked like in your life this next week. I'm not talking about self-denial as passivity or self-negation, a denial of our needs or desires. It's not suffering for the sake of suffering if somehow that's inherently holy or redemptive. Let's not forget that the first half of Mark's account of the gospel describes Jesus' healing, of relieving suffering, of relieving oppression. And self-denial is more than just giving up a particular behavior, though that's sometimes not a bad thing. What if self-denial is about separating from that which we often use to define ourselves and define each other? Political parties, national identities, economic status, family of origin, even religion. What if it is about redefining ourselves, our priorities, our beliefs to be more in line with those of Jesus? What if self-denial is the key to loving our neighbor, to loving our enemy, to loving God, and yes, even loving ourselves? Maybe self-denial is what makes space and place for another person and recognizes her or his life as important, as sacred as mine is. Maybe self-denial is paradoxically what allows us to become alive. Maybe it means re-examining our beliefs, our attitudes about who we are, who another person is, and who God is. finally, maybe self-denial means we don't have to take ourselves more seriously than we take God. Self-denial might just be the medicine we need for our disillusionment.